Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, December the 6th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Foreign policy has suddenly hit the front page. It never really went away, but we were not paying attention to it. So we'll talk a little bit about Russia, troops on the border with Ukraine. There's a pipeline also having to do with Russia, Iran, and a nuclear deal. Of course, China is always in the news, so we'll talk about that. Vice President Harris, quite a few things that are making the end of the year here rather interesting. So let me say Merry Christmas, if it's not too early. Merry Christmas, Bill.
Merry Christmas to you, Silvio. Ho, ho, ho.
I don't know if it's too early to say that. Normally, I guess we would. Yeah, I guess not. Let's be politically incorrect.
I'll check with the Speech Permissions Committee at Harvard. And I'm sure they'll be able to tell us. They're overloaded with problems, though, because as we all know, the speech in America is completely racist, misogynist, sexist, Islamophobic. So they're overburdened. But I know the people. I can get through.
Yeah, why don't you find out? Because I don't want to be too early in saying it. But in all honesty, I usually didn't start saying Merry Christmas until a bit later. I think I probably haven't started yet with many of my friends, but this year, because I want to make the woke people angry, I think I'll start saying Merry Christmas as of today, Bill.
Okay, but you know, if you say it to a woke person, you are responsible for any medical damage.
That's right, or for any looting in San Francisco.
You can't say looting. I think that you are responsible for the actions of any street entrepreneurs.
Yes, that's it. People who've decided to take control of the situation.
That's right. Exactly right. Give them credit.
Give them credit. At least they've got initiative. Well, let me begin with a couple of quick notes here. Gil Hodges, one of the legendary members of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who you grew up watching there in Brooklyn, made it to the Hall of Fame last night. This is part of a special committee that the Hall of Fame created. And they go back and they take a look at players who maybe were overlooked the first time. And somebody like Gil Hodges was probably overlooked the first time because there were so many other great players on that team. Jackie Robinson, you know, the catcher. So many great players on that team. That it's
absolutely
easy to overlook Gil Hodges. But he's in, and I'm happy, even though, of course, he passed away many years ago. But I'm happy that
he's 48.
That means that, yeah, that means that their first baseman, the second baseman, the shortstop, the catcher, the starting pitcher, the right-handed starting pitcher on that team are in the Hall of Fame. That's pretty good, Bill.
Yes.
Five out of the starting lineup. That's not bad.
It's a remarkable record for a remarkable team. People forget that the Brooklyn Dodgers, who actually, remember, didn't even represent the whole city, but simply the borough of Brooklyn in New York City, were in many World Series. They finally won one in 1955, as you know. But they were, and also they were considered a team that was in many ways the spirit of baseball, the hometown spirit, the scrappy spirit, one of the great teams in the history of any sport. And I'm glad to see that Gil Hodges got in. He was so young when he died. He was only 48, which shows that athletes are not automatically immune to early death. And he has never been given the proper respect. Now he's got it.
That's right. And another quick note about Gil Hodges, you may remember this. After, you know, after the Brooklyn Dodgers experience, he managed the New York Mets, and
yes.
they won the World Series, I believe, in 69 with Gil Hodges as the manager. So he had another connection to the city of New York, a different team, but another connection of winning. The other person who passed away, Bill, Bob Dole, now he was 98, I believe. I've always
yes.
liked Bob Dole. I thought Bob Dole was, in many ways, I wish we had more men like him, Bill.
Well, we don't, and I don't know where we're going to get them from. And, of course, if you say men nowadays, remember, you're in trouble. So
that's
you,
right,
you,
yeah.
You've had multiple violations tonight, Silvio. I don't
they
know.
Sure
if
have.
You know, I they're gonna start talking about me. Look at the guy he broadcasts with. I think we're both in a lot of trouble. Bob Dole was the last member of the Greatest Generation, to the best of my knowledge, to serve in Congress. I don't think there were any left. He was 98. He was severely wounded in Italy in World War II. Rose to become the leader of Republicans in the United States Senate, and was the Republican vice presidential candidate back in the 1970s, and the Republican presidential candidate in 1996. So he had
That's
quite a
right.
career.
He really did. He had an amazing career, great career, I would argue. And yeah, he was just a great guy. It's amazing to me, though. He was the presidential candidate in 96, and I think he left politics. So he really been pretty much out of the, you know, off the front page for almost 20 years. And
yes, that's
I find that fascinating. Somebody who was such a big part of our years growing up and following him on TV every night. You know, he ran for president several times, finally got the nomination. After he lost to Clinton, he kind of faded away. And you know, I had not heard from Bob Dole in a long time, except that one moment when he went to the funeral of the late President Bush, when he stood up and saluted, and that was about as emotional as it gets, Bill.
Yes, very much so. And they were sometimes political competitors.
Yes. Well, they were in 88, if I recall. They said some nasty things about each other, but you know, they were tough guys. They knew that politics was a tough game, but I think they respected each other a great deal. And for, I don't know, when he got up like that and saluted the former president, I was very touched by that. I thought that was absolutely great. So Bob Dole, his wife is still active, though. Elizabeth Dole. Yeah, she's still very active, I believe, in different activities. I think at one time she was president of the Red Cross, if I remember.
Yes, she was. That's correct.
Yeah, correct.
She was president of the American Red Cross, and I think a popular president.
And she was also, wasn't she in a cabinet position or considered for a cabinet position?
Yes, I believe she was Secretary of Transportation in one of the cabinets. I don't recall which president it was, but yes, she's been around. She was a lawyer. She was a very accomplished woman, and always conducted herself well.
Yes, she is a nice lady, and Bob Dole was a great man. Well, Bill, you know, you and I talk a lot about foreign policy on Urgent Agenda. You write a great deal about foreign policy, and I know there have been a couple of times over the last few years that we have wondered whatever happened to foreign policy, but all of a sudden it's back in the news and with a lot of force. You've got Russian troops on the Ukraine border. You have the Iran and the nuclear deal. That's getting hot. China and Taiwan, that's always hot. So maybe there's going to be a foreign policy crisis after all, Bill.
Well, you know, foreign policy crises are the highest level of crisis. There used to be a saying that you can have 4 years of bad domestic policy, but if you mess up your foreign policy, it can be fatal. And I think that's true, and I think we've forgotten that the truly nation-ending threats come from abroad, not from the internal United States. Although one can debate that the situation is so bad here these days that maybe that cliche will go out of style. But we face enormous foreign policy challenges. And what is interesting about this day, this period we're in today, is that we're facing two at the same time from two different adversaries. From Russia, we are facing the possibility that they will invade Ukraine. And from China, we are facing the possibility that they will invade and seize Taiwan. And the question is, can we handle either one of them, and can we handle both at the same time?
Well, in either case, though, because I was watching an interview yesterday, and I think it was the Fox Morning News or whatever it was, and they were asking Karl Rove about this, and the question was, are we actually going to get involved militarily in the Ukraine? And the answer is no, but if we don't get involved militarily, what are we going to do? We're going to do sanctions. Maybe we'll do more Twitter hashtags or something, you know, get out of Ukraine or whatever.
Yes.
But I mean, exactly, this is, I guess my point, Bill, is this is why you want to be strong before, so that a guy like
Putin right.
doesn't do it. I mean, once he decides to do it, I think you've lost the battle, Bill.
We have, and I think we probably already have lost the battle, because the suggestions around Washington, and these are these little tidbits that get leaked to the press, the suggestion around Washington is that the president's thoughts go not to any military reaction to anything that the Russians or the Chinese will do, but to economic action. Well, economic action is the kind of a thing that is, first of all, it's a very vague term. What do you mean by economic action? And second, you may be certain that any aggressor nation takes that into consideration before they engage in the aggression. They assume there'll be some response. But the response that most nations would fear would be a military response. And when, in effect, the United States takes that off the table, not that we have yet, but I think we're heading in that direction. If we take it off the table, then you can be sure that you will have an act of conquest by our enemies, and we are not prepared for it.
Well, the other thing that is not prepared, Bill, is public opinion, because we have not really been exactly explaining to the American people what the strategic consequences of either one is. I think a lot of Americans say, okay, it's nasty that Russia goes into Ukraine, or it's bad that China goes into Taiwan, but am I going to send my son over there to fight for one of those two? And since the country has not been prepared for this, tremendous lack of leadership, I think, on the part of President Biden, perhaps you can even blame President Trump for that. You know, the country's not ready. So if tomorrow morning we wake up and I read an urgent agenda that Russia went into Ukraine, is that going to mean that guys are going to be running down to the recruiting station to sign up to defend the country, Bill?
I doubt if they will. I doubt if they will, because this generation is not motivated in that way. They really have not been taught true American history and the true history of conflict. And also, as you said, public opinion. The president has not prepared the nation for the possibility of a military conflict over either Taiwan or Ukraine. And countries must be prepared psychologically. We were really not prepared for World War II psychologically. I think most Americans wanted to stay out. What got to the psychological state was the attack on Pearl Harbor by Japan on December 7th, 1941. Well, okay, there probably won't be anything similar today, because neither of these countries is going to attack the United States. They will attack their objective. In the case of Russia, that's Ukraine, and in the case of China, that's Taiwan.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Pearl Harbor. It will be number 80 tomorrow, which is pretty remarkable.
That's right.
Number 80.
That's
and,
right.
When I saw that note, it reminded me of my friend Bob Jaggers, who passed away earlier this year. He was not in Pearl Harbor during the attack, but he went into war because of Pearl Harbor, and he was at D-Day. But he was always one of these veterans who would go to all these events, you know, anniversaries. And just yesterday, Bill, American Airlines provided a flight to a group of veterans here in the area. Who are going to Pearl Harbor to celebrate number 80. I thought that was very nice. of American Airlines to do that. They're flying them to Pearl Harbor, or Hawaii, I should say. But my concern is that I don't think the country is ready. Both things could actually happen at the same time, because you know if Russia, I mean, they could coordinate these things. Russia and China could coordinate these things. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, how does this administration react to any of that, given how most people don't support the administration right now? I mean, it's just one, I don't think we've been quite like this before. You were right about, you know, Pearl Harbor, and we were not ready for that. But at least I think people had confidence in the chief executive at the time, Bill.
Well, yes, at the time of Pearl Harbor, of course, Roosevelt was in his third term, unprecedented for an American president. He promised to keep the country out of war unless directly attacked. And, of course, obviously, Pearl Harbor was a direct attack. I think the American response to Pearl Harbor was what you would expect of Americans. When directly attacked, we responded very, very well. Now, it's interesting, by the way, that even though we responded well and that the president instantly became a war leader and the recruiting stations were full, it's interesting that in the November midterm election following Pearl Harbor, the president took enormous losses in the House of Representatives. So the act of being at war, even with the president who was doing the job, is not a guarantee of success at the polls.
That's right. That's right. People still, you know, like everybody says, politics is always local. It's always a local thing. So that's what that's what they say. But you know, we've got China, we've got Russia, and then there's Iran, Bill. That's another one too.
Yes.
It could be a threefer.
And of course you've got the Iran nuclear deal right now not turning out maybe as good as they thought it was going to be, and I mean the current administration decided to renegotiate or get back into that deal, but that apparently is not working out either because the government in Iran doesn't seem very interested. So it's like these three things are happening, and I'm not going to blame it all on Joe Biden because that's not, I mean, things are never quite that black and white, but I don't know. I have a funny feeling this would be different if Trump was in the White House, Bill. I really do.
Oh, I think it would be completely different because I think they would take Trump much more seriously. I mean, they may not have liked Trump. I doubt if they liked him. And they may not have even respected him, but they certainly feared him. He was a man who is difficult to like and hard to ignore. They knew that when Trump laid down a marker and said this so far and no further, that he meant it. We know that Obama didn't mean it. He laid down a marker in Syria and let somebody roll right over the marker. And I think we lost a great deal during the Obama administration because of the president's laxness and his lack of commitment to American defense. I think that could happen again right now. I think a lot will depend on the mood of the Chinese and the Russians, whether they want to work together and whether or not they actually want to do this. You know, it is possible that either side is kind of bluffing and simply sending a message of what is coming in the future. There's no guarantee that they want to attack now, and I'm glad of that. But we do not know how to read the minds of an enemy. That is the old problem that you hear about all the time whenever some conflict begins, that we may have very good technical intelligence, but we don't have very good human intelligence, meaning intelligence about people and what's in their mind. And I think that's a situation that we have to face today, too.
Well, I was listening to something on the television yesterday. A former member of the Obama administration was saying that, well, we have to work with our allies, and we have to work with our allies. And I'm sure that really scares the heck out of Putin, you know, when he hears
yes.
that we have to work with our allies, because the last time I checked, they didn't put up a lot of troops whenever a problem happened, you know. So what are the allies going to do to the Soviet Union? I mean, Germany depends on, I mean, not Soviet Union, but Russia. Germany depends on Russia for oil and that pipeline that we're going to talk about in a minute. So, I mean, it's like, I'm not sure what the allies could do. I mean, we're going to have to either do something for ourselves or do nothing and let him take Ukraine or let the Chinese take Taiwan and just say the heck with it. It's none of our business and we're out of here. I mean, that's I don't know what else to do, Bill.
Well, you have a very good point there, because the United States psychologically is not prepared for any war. I don't think it's even prepared in terms of the conditioning of our troops. There seems to be an awful lot of attention in the military today on woke politics and critical race theory, and not very much on critical war theory. And there probably should be more. You know, just think of it this way. We're in the middle of the Thanksgiving to Christmas period. And what if tomorrow we got word that China had moved on Taiwan and simultaneously Russia had moved on Ukraine? What would the American people accept in a situation like that? And also a point that has to be made, what would the Democratic Party accept? Remember, they may be battered right now, but they are still the party in power. Would they have any stomach for a war against China or a war against Russia? I doubt very much. In fact, there's a whole division of the Democratic Party that is rather that is rather isolationist, and will say exactly what you said. Why should this be our bother, since nobody else wants to intervene? Then I think you have a full-blown foreign policy crisis where the world will change and we will no longer be the dominant power.
That's right. That's right. And I hope that I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that Putin actually shows a little bit more restraint. And so do the Chinese, but it's awfully tempting for them to do something right now, because they look at the White House and they don't see a lot of strength there, Bill.
I'm afraid that's true. And, you know, the old story, and it really began with George Washington, who said, if you want peace, prepare for war. And we are not prepared for war, and we do want peace, and we do not have a president in whom Americans have very high confidence, and I suspect that in our war and peace issue, confidence will be even less than in his general confidence ratings. So we are in a situation in many respects that may be worse than the one before Pearl Harbor. At least before Pearl Harbor, we knew that a major war was going on in Europe, and there was some activity in the Pacific, and we knew that it was important. Here, Americans seem completely oblivious of anything going on. They sometimes have to be reminded of what the Iran nuclear deal is in public opinion polls. And I think it is I don't think this is a nation-ending situation that we're faced with, but it certainly is a situation that can weaken us in the eyes of the world to the point where we're no longer considered the leader of the Western world.
I think also the other point that you made a few weeks ago, Bill, is that if countries like Australia and Japan and New Zealand, those countries out in that region, South Korea, if they see China get away with this, they're going to sit there and say, you know, we might as well cut a deal with China because we could be next. And
yes.
You know, that they could
Absolutely.
Very well, you know, they could gain a lot, China, that is, could gain a lot of, you know, a lot of power simply because we decided not to get involved, Bill.
That's absolutely correct. If we show weakness over the Taiwan issue, and if we crumble over the Taiwan issue, there's a whole range of countries in East Asia that they're not going to end their relationship with us, but that relationship will take on a different tone because they will know that they can't trust us.
Right, and think of how emboldened the Chinese would be. I mean, how emboldened they would be if they could take Taiwan. And by the way, I should point out, I think you know this, I think you wrote about this, Bill, that Taiwan is not going to sit back and take a punch. They're going to fight back pretty hard. So if the Chinese go into Taiwan, they're going to have to use overwhelming force to take over Taiwan, because everything I read is that the Taiwanese are ready, and they're going to die defending
yes.
their country. So it's not going to be a piece of cake, but they do have the military power to do it, and they'll use it.
Well, that's true. Now, obviously, in the case of China-Taiwan, even though the Chinese have the military power, that military power, remember, has not been tested and may not be in the best organizational shape today. We hear about the successes, the testing of new planes, the building of new ships, but we should caution that it takes a great deal of talent, preparation, and training to produce a fighting force, a true real-world fighting force, and we really don't know how good they would be if put up against an allied nation of the United States or put up against the United States itself.
Right. I've always felt that Taiwan is a little bit like Israel in the sense that they're probably stronger than they look. You know, Taiwan probably has been preparing for this, and they, you know, that they're a pretty big economy, so they've got the money to spend on defense expenditures. So, again, I hope I don't see it. I hope it never happens. But it's just these are issues that nobody talked about in the campaign. Nobody got into any of this because everybody was obsessed with Trump. And now these issues are hitting us between the eyes, Bill.
They are. And I think there are probably many people who, depending on where they live and who their friends are privately saying, bring back Trump.
Yes. I think when you're at 38% or in the latest Trafalgar poll or 41 in Rasmussen, whatever one you want to believe, no number is good, whatever poll they come up with. And I just think there's some big problems there. And we haven't even talked about inflation or the price of gasoline yet, Bill. We just talked about foreign policy. Let me take a little break,
right.
And then when we come back, we're going to talk a little domestic policy. That doesn't look good either for the Biden administration. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I thought it was interesting talking about domestic issues. There was an article that came out today in Politico and another one in Axios, I think is the other one. And they were basically saying that the message that Democrats are now telling each other is we should not talk as much about Trump. We should talk about the economy. Because, frankly, nobody cares about Trump or January 6th when we go out to our districts to talk to people. I'm paraphrasing, but I do think the Democrats are beginning to realize that talking about Trump ain't going to cut it. They're going to have to come up with something better, Bill.
That's right. I mean, look, if they can talk about Trump all they want, but public opinion polls, as you know, have begun to show Trump more popular than Biden. So why would they want to talk about Trump? It reminds them that they may not have liked the guy all that much, but that during his administration, we had a situation where we were energy independent. We had a better employment picture. We had a better economic picture. There was greater optimism about the future. The streets were not filled with violent demonstrations. We were not confronted every night with people tearing down statues of Abraham Lincoln. So I would not, if I were a Democrat, I wouldn't bring up Trump. Quite the opposite. I would tell the American people, we are running as a party of independence, a party where each person has an opinion that is respected. Now, that may not be true, but that's probably what they should say. And they, you have a deal there where Americans will look at the Democratic Party and see that it's a mess, that it's pathetic. The Republican Party is not in perfect shape, but it's in shape that's a lot more perfect than that of the Democrats.
Yeah. Well, one person who seems to be having a few problems, we spoke about this last week, and I was, you know, I thought that her problems would go away, but they only seem to get worse, and that's the vice president, Bill. I mean, it's like people are resigning and people are talking behind her back. What that says to me, Bill, is that there's a great deal of dissatisfaction in the White House itself, that maybe the fact that we don't really have a strong leader at the top, everybody's kind of out on their own. And, you know, if you don't have a strong president, then you start having all these little groups fighting with each other, Bill.
That's exactly right. Now, you don't have a strong leader at the top of the Republican Party either, because Trump is not really taking the role of party leader. He obviously is probably the most popular person in the party if an election or poll were taken today, but he does not regulate the party. He does not run each operation within the party, and I think the Republican Party understands that and is very wary of it. You know, do we want Trump to come back as the party leader at a time when people still remember the antics that he pulled during his own administration? And I'm not so sure they want him back quite this soon and in quite the form that he's speaking. It's, you know, imagery is a very important part of politics, and Trump never cared much about his image, or at least he claimed not to care, and the people responded to him appropriately. They kind of, in a way, rejected him at the end. I think we can safely say that it was really more in 2020 of a Trump loss than a Joe Biden win. And the Republicans are caught in a situation where their most prominent candidate, Donald Trump, carries a lot of baggage, a lot, and we should admit that. And that's why so many people feel they like having him there, but they would really prefer in the end to have a more stable presidential candidate.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of people who are torn, myself included, with respect to what happens in 2024. Do we want to see Trump come back and probably win? But do we'd rather start all over again with a guy like DeSantis from Florida or whoever, you know, whatever the ticket is. But at least you have a couple of fresh faces that don't have, you know, this kind of controversy surrounding them. So I agree. I think people are torn. But the case of Vice President Harris, you wrote about this, I think, today at Urgent Agenda. You know, I know there have been other problems before between presidents and vice presidents, but maybe because of social media, maybe because of the 24/7 media, we know more now than we did before. But I don't recall seeing anything like this, and I can go back to Nixon Agnew, let's say, and I don't remember, you know, Agnew resigned for other reasons, but I don't remember anything this public before where a vice president, where people were resigning and saying things about her this way, Bill.
I don't remember it either. Vice presidents usually are supposed to just be there and wait for the president to die, and they have, as they usually their highest function, going to the funerals of foreign leaders who no one's ever heard of. You know, they always seem to be ready with that dark suit. And very rarely do you get a truly active vice president. We did in Al Gore. He was quite active in enabling government reform. But most vice presidents, I mean, if you take Joe Biden under Barack Obama, he was never in the news. I don't recall him being involved heavily in one situation. And as far as the vice president under Donald Trump, well, he was a fine vice president, he was. But nobody ever heard of him actually doing anything and getting credit for it. It's a
right.
Very benign office.
Now, Pence did take a role in the virus stuff. I mean, in the coronavirus, in those sessions that they had. In fact, I think I mentioned it to you, Bill, a couple of years ago, or whenever we had those daily meetings at the White House over coronavirus, that I think Trump would have been better off just passing the ball to Pence and letting Pence do those hearings every day or those meetings with the media every day. The media would have been a lot less hostile to Pence than they were to Trump. And Trump would not have been fighting with members of the media every day like he was. And I think that would have been better for the country because the focus would have been more on the virus rather than on Trump. So I think Pence, I think that was a wasted opportunity. He should have been given more responsibility on that, Bill.
I think so. Well, you know, Trump was not exactly generous with opportunity. He kept pretty much everything under his own thumb, and I think it was a weakness.
Yeah, and I think in this case he wasted, I do believe, the more affable, more congenial guy like Pence, who I think was, you know, you can say whatever you want about Pence, but he's, you know, nobody hates Pence. He's not that kind
That's
of
right.
personality like Trump was, and I think the media would have behaved differently, too. Had Pence been doing those hearings, I really do. I think the media would have held back a lot of their scream and stupid questions, Bill.
Well, and that's hard for the media to do. I mean, to hold back stupid questions. It's really, I mean, because they go to stupid question school. You know, to be a White House correspondent, you got to go through that course. You're right. Look, this is all, in a way, elegant speculation. We don't know what the future will bring, and we don't know what the medical future will bring. I mean, Kamala Harris, even in her miserable performance and a disappearing act, could wind up president of the United States tomorrow afternoon.
That's right. Well, heartbeat away. She's a heartbeat away.
Yes.
As they used to say, she's next in line, whether we like it or not. She is next in line, and that could happen. You know, that could happen.
It
you
could.
Never...
And then, yeah. And then she would then, if she became president, her first responsibility would be to select a new vice president. And that could be a political bloodbath in the Democratic Party.
That's right. That's exactly right. It would be interesting. But I go back to the point that I made before. I think all of this is a reflection. All of these inner White House battles are really a reflection on the fact that the guy at the top barely goes to the office, and there, you know, nobody really knows who's in charge. So you've got this people in charge, these people, and I think that's a lot of what's going on, Bill.
Yes, my sense is that people increasingly, even if they may not say it to pollsters, increasingly believe that Barack Obama is in charge. Because if you look at the shape of the administration, including the makeup of the Iran nuclear deal delegation, it's completely from the Obama administration. It's just as if one ended and the other began.
Yeah, it sure looks that way, particularly on foreign policy. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Now, before we get to CNN, Bill, I wanted to get your reaction to last week when we had these arguments before the Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade. Once again, we saw some rather hilarious things coming out of the left, like Justice Sotomayor talking about the political influence of the elections on the Supreme Court as if there was no political influence on the other side when they write opinions. But
right.
I thought overall, I mean, I'm not sure what to make of what the justices were asking or the people were arguing, but people smarter than me were saying that it looks like they may be ready to send abortion back to the states, Bill.
That seems to be the direction in which the questions went. There are theoreticians who are now sitting there with their crystal ball and trying to find something in the crystal ball that will tell them about the future. I never predict the future, but I think we should be aware that it's coming. The court did not seem terribly passionate about overturning Roe, and I think they know what a mess that would make politically in the United States. I think the direction they seem to be going is of upholding the Mississippi law and at the same time upholding Roe. Now, that may seem like a contradiction. It may seem messy, but the court gets messy all the time. And they would get rid of the case, in effect, by turning it back to Mississippi. I think they would, in any final decision, based on what I've heard in the questioning, provide some opening for a Roe to be tested in the states or for abortion decisions to be made in the states. You know, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg said after Roe that she wished the whole thing had gone through the states, because the decision or the outcome would have the support, the popular support of the American people. When the decision came out, Roe v. Wade, most Americans didn't even understand it.
Right. Yeah, and that, it's hard to believe that was 48 years ago, Bill.
Yes.
I mean, it's just hard to believe. That was 48 years ago that Roe v. Wade came out. And for a while there, you know this better than me, but for a while there, it wasn't really an issue, really. I mean, I've read about it, and for a while, nobody really cared much about it, a little bit, but it wasn't really until, I think, the Reagan campaign of 1980, and remember the moral majority and all of that in the 80s, that's kind of when it began to take hold. But people forget that President Ford was actually pro-choice.
Yes.
It's interesting. I was reading about this the other day, that in 1976, The pro-life candidate was Jimmy Carter, and the pro-choice candidate was Gerald Ford. It was not an issue in the campaign, but that's, I think, the last time anything like that happened, Bill.
That's true. Well, it's an issue that erupts periodically when there is a threat to Roe. Roe v. Wade is probably the single most important belief within the women's movement. I mean, the belief in the, quote, what they call the woman's right to choose is sacred in the women's movement. And I don't think that within the movement itself and within its followers in politics, there's going to be much give on that. I mean, they want Roe upheld in a pure environment. They're not going to get it. And I think they're going to be angry in some way. Exactly what way that is, we can't predict it. But I think that the shape that we discussed before, where they uphold the Florida law and at the same time challenge Roe within the states, I think that's the direction that seems to be going.
Yeah, the Mississippi law, you meant. The Mississippi.
Yes,
I think my grandson just picked up. Yeah, but my grandson just picked up the phone on the other side of the house. We have visitors, and he wanted to say hello to you, Bill.
Well,
so
say hello to him back.
Yeah, he is. Now, I don't think they know that he did this on the other side of the room.
Oh, that it is, but I don't know how to hang it.
Oh, okay, there we go, Bill.
We are hearing, but I don't know how to.
Okay, so Bill, you're part of a crisis here with us. Our grandson has actually picked up the phone, and so help me out here, Bill. I think I'm about to do it.
I think that if your grandson has picked up the phone, you tell him you've done.
There you go. I just got you
there
back,
you go.
Right? Yeah,
yep,
we just, he literally, I'm here too. He literally picked up. There you go. Lincoln, you did a good job there. One of your fans.
It is Lincoln.
Yeah, that was Lincoln.
That's right.
He picked up the phone on the other side.
He made one more phone call today than Kamala Harris did.
That's right.
I think you should tell him that. I congratulate
him. That's right.
He's in national politics.
That's right. But he was, all of a sudden, I hear him, and I knew exactly why I was hearing him, because he went to the other room, and he picked up the phone, and I could hear him. And I'm saying, Bill, this is the most interesting interruption we've ever had.
Yes, yes. Well, one of the great things about broadcasting is the concept and the theory and the history of the open mic. When somebody says something and doesn't realize that the mic is on.
But I mean, all of a sudden, I noticed over here on this phone over here that it said conference, and I'm hearing a kid screaming. I knew that it was not on your side, Bill. So
I interpret what he said. He has just announced his candidacy for 2024, and I think
he just wanted to make that very clear that he's not going to be overlooked in 2024. That he's going to be an active participant. But
admire.
Yeah, getting back to what I was saying, one more thing I want to say about Roe v. Wade, and I want to talk about CNN, because that's another mess. But I think you're right. I think eventually, and in fact, that's what I'm hoping they'll do, is they'll say a woman has the right to an abortion, but the states can regulate it. And I think something like that should be a compromise, so that a state like New York, if they want to do whatever they want to do, another state wants to do whatever they want to do, and, you know, at least, you know, if we in Texas want to do whatever we want to do, that's fine. If you in New York want to do whatever you want to do, and I think maybe that's the solution, Bill. That old 10th Amendment seems to be a pretty good idea, Bill.
It does. It does. And I think we will get some kind of an education during this debate in the Constitution. I don't know where it's going to come from. I do not look forward with enthusiasm to the crew at CNN discussing the Constitution. But I think what we are beginning to see what a constitutional conflict looks like. And the court has been in internal conflict before. It's not the first time. And I think it's interesting that there's a possibility that this decision on this particular case could influence the congressional elections next year, depending on
it
which
could.
Side is angry, which side is angrier. Right, yeah. Now it's kind of hands down that the Republicans will win control of the House, but it's not a guarantee, and it is not a guarantee that the victory could be very pyrrhic if the Democrats start fighting back and starting back on reasonable turf.
Yeah. You know, nothing is certain this far in advance, so I think you're right. I think the whole Roe v. Wade thing could be a major, you know, could change 2022, and we'll have to wait and see. CNN, I'd like to get your thoughts on CNN, Bill, because CNN may have actually reached the end of the road, I think, because now you're having this problem with Chris Cuomo. Nobody's watching the station. The ratings are horrible. And the situation with Chris Cuomo is a lot more than a brother helping a brother. I don't have a problem with a brother helping a brother. I can certainly understand that, or at least the sentiment of a brother wanting to help a brother. But in this case, I think it went too far, Bill.
Grossly inappropriate. I mean, he could have taken a leave of absence and said, "We have a family issue, and it's not proper that I broadcast with that on or that I cover that." But apparently, they did a great deal that CNN knows about in advancing Cuomo's position at CNN, and they did it while the network was on the air. And I think that really is something that the audience rejects and resents.
Well, there's also some talk that people above him knew about this, and that's where it could really be a problem for CNN. I mean, if Cuomo was simply lying to CNN, then you could say that CNN was stupid that people let him do this. But apparently other people, he's alleging, Cuomo, that other people knew about this. And if that's the case, there may be some lawsuits all over the place, Bill.
Yes, and not only lawsuits, but there could be complaints to federal agencies. I don't know if any part of CNN is carried over the air. You know, the Federal Communications Commission only regulates over-the-air television, and I don't know whether a problem at CNN would fall into that category because they are a cable system. Also, the CNN is owned by AT&T, which does have over-the-air operations. I am not a lawyer. I don't know if this would ever get to a court, but it's possible there could be some legal ramifications. There certainly could be some legal ramifications if, for example, Cuomo decides to sue CNN for wrongful termination. That simply drags the crisis on, but that may be what he wants.
Well, it could be. It could be. But I think the way I look at it, it's more what the viewers want because they're the ones who are paying the freight, you know, and they're already losing a ton of viewers. I don't know how can this be helpful to a network to have something like this happening? So, you know, maybe this is all going to mean that less people will watch it. I heard something the other day that AT&T or whoever the new management at CNN is, would like to change their format a little bit and take it back to more what it was, let's say, 15 or 20 years ago, with more of a news network and less of a personality show. And I actually think that there would be a lot of people in the country who would be interested in that, Bill.
I think they would improve their ratings. And if they do it, they would have to internally in some way, and there must be some people around who could do this, change the mentality of CNN to make news reporting proud again, to make it the heart of what a news organization is. And I don't know if they have the people to do that, and I don't know if AT&T has the backbone to demand it. Apparently, they're not too worried about money, and that's unusual because given where they are, I mean, I think their income is, you know, $2.25 a night. They really can't go very long on that.
Well, what I'm hearing is that they make money despite the fact that their audience is so small because their operational costs are fairly small. I mean, it's not since they're not, you know, doing broadcasts from all over the world and doing a lot of reporting out in the street, they're basically sitting in a panel talking about Trump. So they don't have a lot of expenses, Bill. That's what I've heard. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's not like it's not a very expensive operation. And so it's fairly profitable. That's what I'm hearing from.
Yeah.
They're actually making money even though they're getting less than 1 million people an hour, Bill.
Yes, well, they have an international system, remember, and that apparently is profitable. They have CNN so-called reporters around the world. They, in fact, began with a large international operation. My feeling is it's one of the more useless news broadcasters in America, because you really cannot trust that what you're getting from CNN is a truthful story. I think they what they do is they are basically an editorial page with reporters attached. They report some news, but they go nowhere near the depth of what a good news operation is, and the American people have seen that depth elsewhere, and I think they would want it from CNN.
Yeah. Well, at this point, you're right. I think if you're not watching CNN right now, I don't think that there's anything they can do to get you back. I think that's true. I mean,
that's
I don't
true.
Watch it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't watch it. At one time, I did, actually. I thought, like, if you go back to, like, the first Gulf War, that they were pretty respected back then. And I watched a lot of CNN during the Kuwait War and all of that, because I thought they were the ones who were providing the coverage, Bill. So back
yes.
then they had respectability, but not now. I mean, no, they're nothing
no.
but anti-Trump, and I don't want to watch that.
They made themselves the anti-Trump network and did so intentionally. And I think you're right. People understand what CNN doesn't understand, and that's Donald Trump is not president anymore.
That's right. And he may never come back either. So that's the other
that's
thing.
Right.
I mean, he's done. He's done at least for a couple more years. Bill, one last question I wanted to ask you. Tomorrow is Pearl Harbor plus 80. That's a big anniversary, not in the sense that there's a lot of people who remember or who were alive that day. I mean, it's very few. But it is an important moment of the 20th century. So you're looking at, I mean, what comes into your mind when you think about Pearl Harbor, 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor? What comes into your mind?
Well, the fact that we're losing that generation. I mean, I think I calculated that the youngest veteran of World War II would be today about 91 or 92. And it's just, you know, a few more years and they'll be all gone. And I think their presence was one of the most stabilizing forces in American politics in the three or four decades after the Second World War, and one of the wisest. By wisest, I don't mean highly educated. I mean wisest. They had seen so much, and they understood the real world, which is not an impression you get from many of the news reporters today.
No, when you consider, you know, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, I mean, they all served. Ford served. Carter didn't directly, but he was involved somehow. So you think of all these men who had positions of prominence, not just in politics, but in, like, Bob Dole, for example, but just even in the business community, all the men who were in that war that were prominent in so many ways, most of them are gone, or they're very old.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I think that is a loss to the country, because that was a generation that did its duty, came back, and did a lot of good for the country, and they call them the greatest generation, and there's a reason for that, Bill.
I fully agree with you. I mean, they may not have wanted to be. They may have done that duty reluctantly, and certainly they didn't want to go off and fight a world war, but they did what they did well, and they went back and made further improvements, as you said, in the country. They weren't a perfect generation, but it was from them that we learned and understood for many decades the importance of national strength as a deterrent to war. You know, that was the
right.
great lesson of the Second World War, and I think we're forgetting that lesson.
That's right. Well, I thought it was interesting. They had a little biography yesterday of Bob Dole. Here's a kid who was born in Russell, Kansas, and there he was growing up, and I'm sure the last thing in his mind was at age 15 or age 16 that he would be going to fight a war. But there were so many kids like that around the country, from all
Absolutely.
These little towns who all of a sudden got the call, or either they went down to register or they got the telegram or whatever, and every one of them did their duty. And that's what I admire most about that generation, Bill. They did their duty. Some didn't come back.
That's
we know that. Or some came back.
That's
yeah, you know,
400,000.
That's right. Some came back disabled, you know, like Bob Dole. But nevertheless,
right.
he did something. So that's what I admire most. That's what I think about when I think about these anniversaries, the fact that these were great men and women, the women back here who did their duty too. And they're not around anymore, but I sure hope we remember what they did, Bill.
I do too, and I hope that we remember the lessons that were handed down from that period and from that generation, and which kept this country on a pretty even keel for many years after they came back from war.
Well, Bill, you've got the scoop that that Lincoln is running for president. So
yes,
you've got the scoop, so you can publish it anytime you feel that we need to do that, Bill.
Well, I understand he's looking for a running mate. I want him to know that I am available, and I think it could be a terrific ticket. Look at the theme, another Lincoln for the White House.
Hey, you couldn't get any better than that. Another
That's
Lincoln
right.
in the White House, that would be a great one. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time. A lot of fun to do this with you, and thank you for the great work that you do at Urgent Agenda. And I don't know if Lincoln will join our next podcast, but you never know. If he's around the house, he may pick up the line again, Bill. He knows how to do it now.
I will yield my time to him.
All right. Have a wonderful day, Bill.
Same to you, Sylvia.
Thank you so much. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, with a little help from my grandson Lincoln, who decided to get involved over on the other side of the house. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.